morning, diners, travelers of the world, and good morning, Peter.
I never know quite what you're going to say.
I never know quite what I'm going to say either.
We never know what might be coming out. But
yeah, well, and if everybody's listening, On the Menu, and we have a whole new adventure coming up that Peter now is going to tell you about.
But don't forget to keep track of everything that's going on the Menu at www.onthemenuradio.com. And for the first time in 5 years, in February, On the Menu is headed down under to the great world that some people call Australia, and because people can't spell, it's now called OZ Oz, sounding like the same thing. So we're going to be doing a great review of dining and wine and all the wonderful, exciting things that happen in the island continent down under, sometimes it's called. But excitingly, this morning we have the opportunity to talk to one of the shining stars of the Sydney restaurant scene, and not only the Sydney restaurant scene, but other places in the world as well. One of our absolute favorite chef people from Sydney, Luke Mangan, who used to have a place called Salt. He has several other places in Sydney. And Salt's scattered all over the world, and other restaurants all over the world. Luke, what brings you to the United States today?
Well, we've just launched a wonderful new TV show called Appetizing Adventures, which airs on the Ultra Channel. But what that did, it took me through Asia, and I went to Singapore, Hong Kong, Bangkok, Vietnam, all these places, Japan, Manila, and Mumbai. And I learned the different cultures of food and went to the different markets and learned everything about how they live with their food styles, etc. And I took it back to my restaurant in Sydney which is called Glass,
right?
In the Sydney Hilton, I got some mates over, and for the food that I was inspired by, I came up with some ideas, and you know, got them to vote on it and whether they think it should be on my menu or not. So
that's cool.
It was good fun. But you know, for example, in Singapore we had a laksa, which was amazing.
Right.
But laksa was, you know, it can be quite spicy. And I don't like spicy food, so you can imagine my tour.
Oh, dear.
But, you know, after that, I roasted the barramundi fillet, served it on rice noodles with a laksa sauce, to my version of the laksa sauce. And, it works well. And I think travel for a chef is very important, and that is how you learn and come up with ideas. And
absolutely.
I think what Appetizing Adventures does is shows the audience how a chef thinks and how we can create dishes for our menu.
How do we get that?
Of course, you could.
That shows on the Ultra Channel Wednesday nights and at 8:30. Yeah,
that must be a channel we don't get. I have to submit something here for your consideration. I think you could probably put chocolate ice cream on barramundi, and it was still taste fabulous. You can get it here, but it's farmed and it's just not the same.
That's
product
right,
at all.
Yeah, the wild stuff is good.
Well, in New York, what channel is this on?
Well, it's as far as I know, it's the Ultra. It's with the Dish Network.
Okay.
So I'll leave that to you guys.
All right,
we'll figure that
out and report to our audience. Okay. And you also opened a place in San Francisco.
That's right. About 3 months ago, we opened an Australian New Zealand restaurant wine bar. And I know how much you guys love wine, as well as I do.
Right.
But, you know, so what we've done there, it's quite small, but we've called it South, S-O-U-T-H. And if people want to find out about my restaurants, they can look at www.lukemangan.com. But South is a very casual place, small, serving only Australian New Zealand wines. And really, we're flying in barramundi, Australian lamb, Australian beef, Tasmanian salmon. So we're trying to really promote Australian food. And I think my food has a little bit of an Asian twist because we're so close to Asia and Australia.
Oh, certainly.
And it's a great, fun place. And you know, we're not saying we're doing anything better than what's happening in California or San Fran, because I think the food and the wine is amazing. But we're just trying to offer something different. And thankfully, so far, so good.
Where did you eat in San Francisco, out of curiosity?
I love Boulevard.
Uh-huh.
Nancy Oaks, you sit at the bar there and you watch the kitchen. That is amazing.
Yeah.
I love a little cafe called Zuni.
Oh, because Zuni's great, yeah.
Which is great. And another great place, Coco 500.
And that one I don't know.
That's around the corner from South, actually. So it's very good. I love the eating there.
Did you get to Gary Danko?
No, I didn't. But that is my next stop. Next time I go to San Fran, I'll be eating there.
Yeah, next time you go to San Fran, let us know, and we'll put you in touch with Pat Coletto, who owns Boulevard, a fabulous vineyard estate, and, well, it's too complicated to go into now, but yeah. Let us know.
Okay, wonderful.
Now, what else do you
in Tokyo. We opened this year, we opened Salt in Tokyo.
Did you really?
You went to Salt in Sydney.
Right.
We sold half of a brand to a Japanese company. We don't have Salt in Sydney anymore, but we have Glass in Sydney in the Sydney Hilton. We have Salt in Tokyo. And Salt in Tokyo is pretty much, we replicated what Salt Sydney was and took it to Tokyo. And, you know, we sell about 15 to 20 Southern Rock lobsters from Western Australia a day.
Oh, shit, that's a lot.
It's amazing. And the Japanese are so passionate about food and wine, etc. And it's quite incredible. And we have a little wine bar next door to Salt, which is called World Wine, because in Salt we've only, again, got Australian, New Zealand wine. But I wanted the World Wine Bar, which speaks for itself, I think, just wines from all around the world.
Right. Now, do you still have the Bondi Beach place?
No, we're just in Sydney because we've downsized to try and expand overseas. So,
right.
So we've just got Glass in Sydney and then Salt in Tokyo and South in San Francisco. And, you know, ultimate dream one day is to have a restaurant in here in New York. So
that's like tough. Place. I know you've been trying on that for a while.
Yeah, I'm getting gray hairs about it.
Okay. Well, it's complicated. It's probably the hottest market, I think, of the world, don't you think?
I think so. There's amazing restaurants in New York. You know, I think I love everything that Drew Nearpont does, everything that Mario Batali does.
Oh, he's funny.
Yeah. I think they're all very talented.
Yes. Do you have new hot bars now that, like, remember Fix used to attract Nicole Kidman, remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you don't have celebrity bars now.
Well, I mean, we're still, you know, your question is cooking for celebrities? Is that what you...
Well, you can, that's how you can translate it, yes.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of, we're still doing a lot of that sort of stuff. You know, we cook for the Prince and Princess of Denmark. We've cooked on Richard Branson's private island in the Caribbean.
Oh, wow.
He flew us over there to cook on that. Spent 10 days there. I didn't do much cooking, I must say. But,
I wanted to convey that, I mean, every scene, every restaurant or bar that you go into or wine bar, lounge, whatever, it has so much style and so much buzz that you do attract a really sophisticated, fun crowd.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's what it's all about, isn't it?
Yes.
A restaurant and a wine bar is not just the food and wine that you serve, it's the ambience and the, you know, design, etc. So it's a very important thing.
And what's changed and what's going on in Sydney in the restaurant scene?
Well, I mean, since 5 years ago, I mean,
everything.
there has been a lot changed. There's lots of new developments and restaurants opening, but a lot of the main players are still there, as you would imagine. Tetsuya, who's still going very well, and but I don't know if you remember the Woolloomooloo Wharf, which is... Do you remember that?
Yes.
I don't know that we got that.
Well, we know about it.
They have a restaurant called Otto, which is great. But another new one that's open on there, which is one of my favorites, is called China Doll. So when you're in Sydney, you must try that and tell them I sent you.
All right.
And, you know, there's always the great Italian food in Sydney with... Lucio's and Bon Ricordo.
Oh, Lucio's is still going.
Oh, yeah. I think nearly 25 years now.
Wow.
So there's lots of great little eateries still. Did you ever go to Long Grain?
No.
No, that's sort of a good Thai Asian sort of style restaurant.
Okay.
Communal table dining, but very good.
Okay. That's good. Well, some of the same players. I mean, a lot of them moved over to London, I know.
Yeah.
What's the name with the breakfast place?
Oh, Bill.
Bill's.
Yeah, he's still got that. He's got three Bills now in Sydney.
And he's in London also.
Yeah, I believe so, yes. And he's doing very well, so yeah.
Wow.
And I guess Neil Perry's been heard from again too, right?
Neil's opened something up in Melbourne called Rockpool Bar and Grill. He's closed Rockpool, his main restaurant in Sydney.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, and he's opened a cheaper version. It's called Rockpool Fish. Which is in the same building as Rockpool and is now called Rockpool Fish, which is, I believe, doing very well. And you know, just doing great seafood, so that's a good thing.
Now, is all the dining primarily still concentrated in Sydney? I mean, there were some places. In fact, you have a friend in Melbourne.
Look, I think Melbourne could almost be a notch above Sydney at the moment. Because
really?
Look, there's lots of new places. You know, you've actually got Nobu, who's opened down in Melbourne in Crown. Neil Perry's new restaurant, Rockpool Bar and Grill, which is great.
Right.
There's a great restaurant called The Botanical. Paul Wilson is the chef there. He's fantastic. And you've got your traditional, you know, Guy Grossi, who has Grossi Florentino. I'm not sure if you've ever been there.
No.
Which is, it's a very big building, beautiful restaurant. He has an upstairs fine dining Italian, which is amazing. Then downstairs, which I love also, is his, it's called The Grill, the Grossi Florentino Grill. And I think he's doing very, very well. So Melbourne's got lots and lots of different food.
Yeah, we're going to be there for the Food and Wine Festival.
Oh, okay. You know, there's a place called Vieux du Monde. Shannon Bennett is a great new young chef coming up, and Vieux du Monde is a very recognized restaurant.
I'll tell you, this is a far cry from when we lived in Geelong, I can assure you.
Luke, do that name again. Vieux?
It's called Vieux du Monde.
V-I-E-W?
It's V-U-E. Vieux du Monde, yeah.
That's French.
Huh? Yeah.
Now, what else would you like to tell our listeners?
There's so much more we can tell, isn't there? I mean, I look forward to them all, you know, looking at Appetizing Adventures, our show, and learning from that. And, you know, I think travel through... have you traveled through Asia?
Not yet. We just now have enough time to deal with long, long trips.
Yeah.
Although we've interviewed a lot of Asian cookbook authors lately.
Yeah.
Into the Vietnamese Kitchen. Have you seen that one?
No, I haven't. No.
I mean, well, there are a slew of them, so I imagine that the more people are going to be familiarized with.
Yeah,
with.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
Which of the Southeast Asian countries did you find most amazing?
Well, I do love Tokyo because of their passion for food and wine and obviously the Tsukiji fish markets, et cetera.
Oh, that fish market. Did you go to that tuna thing?
Yeah, yeah, we did. So we actually, something on the show, we went to the fish auction, the tuna auction, and we bought some tuna, and they filleted the tuna in front of me. It was incredible. And, you know, there I am eating sushi at 5 in the morning or something like that. So that was a great experience. But, you know, also through Vietnam and Bangkok, and they were great experiences. Hong Kong's a beautiful city. The food culture, they're very passionate there.
Now, you had a video camera, so it's all, you have all these photos.
Well, it's all in the show, Appetizing Adventures. It shows you my tour of each city and learning and eating all different foods.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Now, let's do this for our listeners, Luke, online right now, and do it for us too, because we'll remember, because we're headed for Salt in just about 6 weeks from now. Let's suppose we were sitting down to dinner.
Glass.
At lunch or dinner at Salt.
Glass.
A glass.
Glass. God, yeah, my mind is playing tricks with me. I just had to go off and answer the door, so I got disconnected. What would be a typical menu you'd recommend, just so people can sort of conjure it up in their minds and feel jealous when we go there?
Well, I think, you know, when you come to Glass is a big restaurant. We seat about 200. We have a 40-seat wine bar attached to the restaurant.
Wow.
It's a beautiful, beautiful design. We got Tony Chi to design it for us. And it's big, it's beautiful ambiance, lots of wines, wines from all over the world. But the food, I think, you know, I suppose it's a modern Australian brasserie is what I put it down to. Simple, clean, well-executed food. You know, you might have a roast fillet of pork with a cauliflower puree and vanilla butter roasted figs. Or you might have a salmon gravlax with Melba toast. You may have, we've got a great dish that we cooked that is on one of the episodes in the show, the sashimi of tuna with soba noodles and wasabi dressing. So it's got versions of a little hints of Asia, Japan, French and Italian through the menu. But there's lots of variety there.
Wow. It sounds like a very exciting opportunity.
Yeah. When you come out, I look forward to doing a special tasting menu for you.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you're not there, I know the guys in the back will do a good job anyway.
I think they do it better when I'm not there.
You said that before, actually.
You did say that. I think that the first time we were there for lunch, I think chef number 3 was in charge, and you couldn't tell the difference. The food,
yeah, well, look,
the food
I'm very
is
lucky
so terrific.
Funny, you know, my chef at Glass in Sydney, he's been with me for 7 years. My chef in Tokyo has been with me for 10 years. And my chef in San Francisco has been with me for 4 years. So, you know, we all work very closely together, and we all trust each other, and I trust them immensely. And they know what I want, and they've got freedom as well. So that's a good thing.
Well, I trust we will have a splendid experience. And I hope we actually get to see you somehow.
Well, so do I, yeah. I mean, I'm going to look into it when I get back. Please just send me an email before you leave, and we can go from there.
That's great.
Yeah.
Luke Mangan, superstar chef, all around nice guy. it sounds like you're doing as a sort of a cleaned up version of Anthony Bourdain going around the world.
You know what? It pretty much is. I'm not into, you know, I've seen some of his shows and he can eat some pretty strange stuff.
But
I think what our show is all about is really giving the viewer the opportunity to see how a chef's mind thinks in creating a menu, but also understanding a city and learning from different chefs in each city. And I get tours of every food market in each city.
I love markets.
Have you ever been to a water market?
No, neither did I.
And in Bangkok or Vietnam, I can't quite remember, but we went on a boat about, you know, 20 minutes out on a boat, and we went to a market on the water. So there's all these boats selling different fruits and vegetables on the boats. It was quite incredible.
Why? I mean, why?
Well, our water market, it's just a different thing because a lot of these people live on boats, so they operate their business out of the boats.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like when we were in Amsterdam, the flower market. Market's on a pontoon on the river.
That's right, yeah.
Well, Luke, we're so delighted to have the opportunity to catch up with you. We hope you'll have a wonderful tour the rest of the time you're in the United States.
Yeah, well, I will. I love it here. So I thank you very much, Peter and Anne. I look forward to seeing you in Sydney, down under.
It's great talking to you again, Luke. Thanks. Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Bye. Wasn't that fun? It's always so great talking to Luke. I feel like he's an old friend, and I really look forward to our visiting there. Pat Rabbit, I think it's now time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We're continuing on our adventure, this time into Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore. Our guest on the line right now is James Osland, and he wrote The Cradle of Flavor. And I want to say hello to Peter before he screams at me. Hi, Peter.
I'm not going to scream at you. If I'm positioning this correctly, it's following right after Luke Mangan, who said a lot of his cuisine in Australia owes a lot to Asian flavors. So I don't know if you have any comment on that, James, to start out, or whether you just want to start out saying how come you became so absolutely totally absorbed in the herbs and spices of East Asia?
Well, I can answer both questions, and thank you, by the way, for having me. This is a real pleasure.
You might as well also mention your affiliation with Severo Magazine. I think that's a de rigueur.
We hope so.
And you were editor-in-chief of
Severo
Magazine. Okay, and now your life story.
well, you know, in answer to the Australia part of the question, Indonesia and Australia are just, they're right in the same neck of the woods. In fact, as the crow flies, the northernmost point of Australia, it's just a good 100-150 miles from some of the southernmost Indonesian islands. It's very, very, very close.
And yeah, for when we lived there, people just totally ignored the Asian influences.
Well, that was because 1939 to 1945 were a lot closer then.
The
Oriental influence that Australians were still highly impressed with was what we laughingly used to call the Yellow Peril, which was the Japanese army threatening to invade and actually bombing Darwin in the process of the war. So it's taken a few decades for the attitude of Australians to turn around, but now it seems to have turned around 180 degrees. And as you're saying, there are excellent reasons why there's such a close affiliation, because of the close geographical proximity, but also because these are flavors that are traditional in that region, but I guess they're flavors that have been around, you know, they're flavors that are viewed as modern as well. I mean, do you see them that way as well, James?
Well, I mean, I think that the taste that you find in Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore are just extraordinary, vibrant, really, really delicious, approachable flavors, especially for us in the West. I know sometimes the foods that we find in parts of Thailand can be a bit challenging to our Western palates. But in my experience of traveling to and indeed living in these three countries over the last over 25 years now, I really firmly believe that in general, the flavor palette that you encounter in dishes is very, very somehow subliminally identifiable to us. And I think probably it's mostly due to the fact that a lot of our favorite spices, nutmeg, clove, for instance, ginger even, are indigenous or believed to be indigenous to the region. I mean, right there stretching along the equator, it's an incredibly abundant, you know, it's like a living greenhouse, the amount of things that just grow there originally in the wild and certainly not, are now cultivated and then indeed cultivated throughout the world.
Now, explain how you landed. I mean, you spent most of your life exploring this area, and how did you get there?
I have indeed almost explored, you know, a good more than half of my life exploring that region. I made my first trip when I was 19 years old. I was in college in San Francisco, which is where I'm originally from.
You were an art student.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Met a by happenstance one afternoon up with a fellow classmate, a woman named Tanya, whom I learned came from Indonesia. I didn't know her at that point. We grabbed a coffee. And just very casually, the summer vacation at that time was approaching. She said, oh, do you want to come to Indonesia for a month or two over the summer? You can stay with my family. You'll have a wonderful time. And it turned out that her family, they were a very politically well-connected group of people. In fact, her father was, for all intents and purposes, one of the founding fathers of the country. He was the adopted grandson of the first prime minister, Bung Hatta, and was
oh, that's how you pronounce that. I didn't know.
And he was also he was very connected with Sukarno, that very complicated first president of Indonesia, who did lots of wonderful things for the country, and then maybe some not so great things.
Some not so great things, right?
But I, at the time, knew very, very little about the country. What I learned later is that it's the world's fourth largest country, just behind us, the United States, population-wise. It's a huge, vast place to go from the northwestern tip of the country, which is the island of Sumatra, all the way to the center of the island of New Guinea. The western part of New Guinea is part of Indonesia proper. That's basically roughly the distance from Fairbanks, Alaska to Florida. It's a vast, vast, complicated, amazing country.
And the cuisines vary in the extreme from section to section.
Wildly. I mean, for instance, in the island of Java alone, Java being the most important island of Indonesia, and where Jakarta, the capital city, is. Gosh, you know, the population of Java, I think, is something. It's bigger than Russia. It's about 160 million people.
Yeah, I remember from geography, it's incredibly densely populated.
Incredibly densely populated, but I'll tell you, when you're there, you don't really get a sense of it. It's really quite beautiful. Most of the population is rural, and in Java, there are amongst many more, there are three very, very specific set cuisines that are also related to ancient cultures that stretch back 2,000, if not 3,000 years on the island.
And that's why you call it the cradle of flavor?
That's one of the reasons, and another one of the reasons is what I was sort of hinting at a few minutes ago, that so many of our favorite spices, so many of our favorite flavorings came from this region, and is indeed, you know, what brought you know, the West's explorers back in the 15th century and the 16th century in searching for spices. Nutmeg at the time was used as a prophylaxis against the plague, and it was a highly coveted food. I mean, originally it was a kind of medicine, and of course later on we came to know it as a flavoring in foods. The Westerners who first traveled to the region were preceded by the Chinese and by the Indians, who had been traveling, well, goodness, for at least a good 1,000 years before the first Westerners arrived on the scene. And they'd been leaving behind little bits of their cultures, religions, and certainly ways of approaching food. And one thing you'll find in the foods of of all the region, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore, which are just next door and very closely related, are a lot of influences from China and India in the most wonderful way.
About your book, I wanted to say, first of all, the photographs are mouthwatering.
Thank you.
Great. But you, in addition to these home cooking recipes, that means that those listeners, you can get this book and actually cook these dishes at home if you can access the spices, which is, in this day and age, pretty easy on the Internet. That you intersperse your stories so that it is a book that one also reads. And as I said, I read it cover to cover. So I mean, your adventures are so exciting.
That's very, very, very flattering to hear. I think that for me, well, after that first trip with Tanya, which was back in 1982, I've been back to the region more than, well, at this point, I've lost count, but it's somewhere between 25 and 30 times. It's become a kind of second home to me. It just became so deeply comfortable to me. It kind of became my place. I think that for me, I wanted to write a love letter to this place.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And it's almost like a kind of, yes, it's a cookbook, and I really, really want people to cook from this book and really get to know these foods that, for the most part, we're unfamiliar with in the West, mainly because there's not a large expatriate population from Indonesia or, for that matter, from Malaysia or Singapore. Outside of Australia, you'll find a few, and certainly in Holland, there are a bunch of Indonesians due to the fact that Holland was the colonizer of the Indonesian islands for four centuries.
Well, you know, oddly, when we moved to Pittsburgh, I was flabbergasted. We had one of these expatriate Indonesians in town who had a small restaurant, and we could go and do the rice stoffel.
Oh, nice.
He's since closed. But, I mean, where would you not find somebody?
Oh, nice. Yeah, I really want people to just know these foods that certainly transformed my palate from a real, you know, meatloaf and potatoes kind of American palate that it was prior to my first trip over there. But I really want people to know these foods. I think they're really accessible, great, exciting foods that can really zing up people's daily cooking ways, as well as, you know, the special occasion kind of cooking that we like to do.
I wanted to ask you, what's going to happen? We hear so much. What's going to happen with the very famous street foods?
How do you mean what's going to happen?
I mean, once they start imposing all the sort of health department standards and so forth, a lot of that goes away, doesn't it?
Well, I'll tell you, in Singapore, you know, Singapore is a small country. It's about it's a little over 3 million people on a very small island, about as big as the Bronx land-wise. I'm not sure what the square mileage is, but it's a small place. At one point in time, not that long ago, around the turn of the 20th century, it was a backwater. In fact, it was a dirty, filthy backwater. And so when Singapore kind of came into its own in the 50s and 60s, there was independence was achieved from Britain, who had been the previous colonizers of the place. They got real determined to show the rest of the world, we're clean, we're not a dirty place. Mm-hmm. And so they put into place very, very, very stringent sanitary rules.
Yeah, we've been in the airport. I've never seen anything so clean and tidy in my life.
It's extraordinary. It really puts us to shame here in America.
It does.
Quite amazing. But you'll find that kind of throughout the region. Indonesia is a vast, and I mean, I'm not so crazy about that terminology, third world, but it's a bit backwards. It is kind of like going 100 years back in time in many parts of the country. But I'll tell you, the street food that I've eaten in the country, it's almost like, you know, it's almost like eating in someone's home, and like some lovely old lady makes the food in the morning in her home, and then she delivers it herself to her street food stall at some point in the morning or in the afternoon. And you might as well be eating in her home, but instead you're eating at some place on the side of the road, and it's just great, soulful, really delicious food.
So they're not doing, they're the Vietnamese, they're moving the street food vendors into like food courts.
It's the Singaporeification of Vietnam, I think you're referring to.
Now, you started out your adventures in, you said in Thailand, though, but you never explained how you slid over to the next country. But
he started in Indonesia.
He started in Indonesia too. I misheard that.
Yeah, you misheard
okay,
that.
Okay.
No, his friend was from Indonesia.
That's me not paying attention.
Tanya. Yeah, this is an unusual fern curry with shrimp. I mean, you have some very unusual recipes here. You must have been gathering them from, I don't know, you had good connections, because most people can't locate these recipes.
Well, I'll tell you, it's just, you know, I've traveled a lot.
You were in a number
of
homes.
Pardon me?
You were in a number, your connections put you into a number of private homes where I think you had a different perspective than most people.
That's right, but I'll tell you, you know, I've traveled a lot around the world, and in Indonesia especially, Malaysia and Singapore too, but Indonesia especially tends to be, I mean, really, from my experience, one of the friendliest places on the planet. And it's a very, very easy, welcoming place to travel. You can be, you know, just in a market, inquire about an ingredient, and there will be some terrific home cook who's buying that ingredient, and she or he, it's usually a she, will explain it to you. And, you know, it's happened to me on probably at this point literally hundreds of occasions where I'll just be invited home into someone's home to taste what food they'll make out of that ingredient.
I'm so envious. Well, I must say, we will be in touch with you when we're about to venture into Indonesia. How's that?
Oh, do. I can give you a nice rundown.
What was the thing the spice that you associate the most with that experience? What stunned you the most in the area of spice?
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, there are sort of like, you know, on the one hand, you've got your spices, these spices that are indigenous to the region and are used in its curries and sometimes even its stir fries. The nutmeg, the cloves, the mace, the cinnamon. Really, really gorgeous, warm taste. And then there are the ingredients that are more really technically aromatics, and that would be like lemongrass, kaffir lime leaves, fresh turmeric, which is a very, very common ingredient over there. They do use the dried form, the dried powdered form of turmeric, but they also use a lot the fresh ingredient. And I'll tell you, I love both camps of flavors a lot, those spices and those aromatics, but I am particularly drawn, and still am, to ingredients like kaffir lime leaves and lemongrass,
yeah,
and just that great.
Oh, James,
brightness.
I did not bring my lemongrass plant in. It's been around for a long time. I didn't bring it in. It just died.
Yeah, she wouldn't let me bring it in, James. Can you imagine that? She committed lemongrass aside.
Oh, no.
It was just too big. You have to start over.
Now there might be a little fish sauce in some of these things, too, right?
In fact, fish sauce is virtually unknown.
Oh, no kidding.
In these three countries, yeah,
okay.
It doesn't exist. That's what you'll find more up in Thailand, okay, in Vietnam, and Laos, and Cambodia. You'll find
okay.
that in that up there instead. But in this sort of southern part of Southeast Asia, instead they have an ingredient that's somewhat comparable to fish sauce, and it's made out of tiny brine shrimp that are gathered in the South China Sea. And it's widely available in all Asian markets in the United States. It's just not a very known ingredient. It's called dried shrimp paste. It goes by two local names there. In Malaysia and Singapore, it's known as belacan, and in Indonesia, it's called terasi. And it serves the same purpose as fish sauce. It adds a kind of subtle umami to dishes. It's used very, very frugally, however. You use only the slightest little bit of it.
I'll bet, yes, I can imagine. and their chilies and so forth. Well, James, I think that listeners should understand that this is going to give them wanderlust, and you're going to want to sample these foods and to follow your story, which was certainly exciting. Anybody who wants it is Cradle of Flavor, and it's James Oseland, Oseland.
And of course, you can find it on OTM and OTM Bookshelf on our website.
Right.
So it's easy for you to get a copy.
Click order and start enjoying these exotic dishes that are available for the home cook through your recipes.
And James, thank you so much for providing your insight into the book and into the whole subject of the book, Cradle of Flavor. Certainly sounds like a flavor adventure for everyone who's looking for a new one.
Oh, I hope so. It's been a joy talking to you both.
Well, you're terrific. So,
and we're probably going to say goodbye to James. Thank you, James, and we're going to take a break now.
Yes.
Okay. Bye, you guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks a lot.
And thank you.
Talk to you shortly.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station. www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And you can always email us if you want to chat with us. It's on the menu at onthemenuradio.com. And please check out our website.
Peter's still here, believe it or not.
Oh, I sat with Ann and Peter.
Yeah, there you go.
Hello, Peter.
I have a voice.
Uh-huh.
I may not get a word in edgeways in the upcoming interview because you're a real fan talking to someone who's cooking
yeah.
You really love.
I don't think Susan really understands who she's talking to. I mean, I just absolutely adore your cooking.
Oh, sure I do. Absolutely. So, you guys have been doing this for a while.
Yeah, but this is now Susan Spicer of two iconic restaurants in New Orleans. Susan, I would like, first of all, how did you get to where you are, being an icon yourself and at such a young age? And also,
when we get off the air, I'll tell you.
Oh, well, they must have airbrushed this cover then. So
oh,
it was pretty, well, we've
you.
Seen you in person, but it's been a while.
Yes.
So, anyhow, how did you get to where you are? And then tell us about Bayona and Herbstone.
Well, thank you. I would say I got to where I am through lots of many hours of hard work and a lot of good luck. So, you know, I think that's how most successful people get where they are. And
now, are you a
little
native?
Bit of luck and a lot of hard work.
Now, are you're not a native, are you?
I am almost a native.
Okay.
I was born in Key West, Florida, from a naval officer father and my mother from Denmark.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah,
that's
and then we lived a couple of different places after Key West, but we moved to New Orleans in 1960. So I consider myself, I was pretty young. I was, you know, well, if I tell you how old I was, you'll know how old I was.
Yeah, you're tripping.
You don't have to say a word.
I grew up here, and I really consider New Orleans my hometown.
Yeah. Part of the story that I really like is you just happen to be walking along Dauphin Street one day, and you looked in through the window of this building.
And it's a beautiful building.
And it turned out eventually to be a restaurant because you had a friend who said, whenever you want to open a restaurant, I want to finance it for you, or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah, it was one of my customers at the restaurant where I was before, the Bistro at Maison de Ville.
And everybody needs a friend like that.
Well, yes, and we're still friends after almost 18 years
that's,
of partnership.
That's wonderful.
That's pretty good.
That's very unusual.
It is unusual.
Yeah, you really were lucky with that.
Very fortunate. So that was Regina Kiever, and we opened in 1990. So, you know, 30 years after I moved to the city, I opened a restaurant here. And Bayona's in a beautiful 200-year-old Creole cottage.
It's absolutely charming beyond
belief. It is a really charming, pretty place. And I always said that if I was going to have my own restaurant, it had to have a courtyard so we could dine outside in the European style, which I've always loved. And then, 10 years later, I opened Herbstone with Donald Link, who was my former sous chef from here, who had been in California and was originally from Lake Charles, Louisiana. And we opened Herbstone together in the kind of the warehouse arts district, sort of a, you know, an up-and-coming, really nice.
And we sat in the window. It was charming.
And watched the streetcar go by.
Yeah, it was really great. Watching people,
nice.
Too.
Now, the streetcar is going back by again, too, right?
You know, I don't think they're going yet. The Canal Street to Carrollton Avenue is going, but I'm not sure if the St. Charles one is back up and running yet.
Do you know what I always remember at my first impression of your restaurant was? We sat in that room with the trompe l'oeil.
Yes.
And there was an insect. Was there not an insect?
Yes, there's a lizard going after a fly that looks realistic.
And I always think of that. Isn't that bizarre?
It's funny. We call that the Dyer Room because Joel Dyer was the artist who painted it for us. He's also a good friend of ours. So.
Okay, the piece of it that sticks in my mind the most is the wonderful job you did with mirrors because it makes the restaurant look 3 times as large as it really is.
Yeah, and the mirrors were actually there. It was a restaurant for a while before we opened it. You know, and then we kind of, you know, did a turnkey operation. And so it was quite nice because we were able to get open pretty quickly.
Now, your influences are strongly Mediterranean, are they not?
They were predominantly Mediterranean, but, you know, over the, you know, the almost 20 years that I've been here, I've done a lot of traveling and...
Yeah, I see wonton chip crisps.
You know, I love Thai food. I've really taken the opportunity to explore the cuisines of the world. You know, there isn't any kind of food that I don't like personally. You know, I love to eat exotic food and, you know, I love to travel. I guess that's from my dad in the Navy who dragged us around from one place to another. But, you know, so really, although I trained with French chefs, and my first love really was when I discovered Mediterranean cuisine and all those good things, you know, from that, I guess it was, you know, a very big deal for me. But I really do, we do a lot of Asian. We do a lot of Latin. I have a wonderful chef, a chef de cuisine named Jeremy Gresham, and he has the same curiosity that I do. And so we really do explore the world on our menu. Now, we don't fuse the cuisines of the, you know, so we're not really doing fusion food, but we might do a Greek salad and a, you know, a Japanese, you know, fish dish and a, you know, chili relleno for our vegetarian entree and things like that. You know, we keep each dish fairly pure, but we do mix and match on the menu quite a lot.
Yeah, here we have a cream of celery soup followed by Indonesian peanut celery soup.
Right, and that just kind of shows you, and that was actually, you know, the cream of celery is, I would say, fairly traditional, you know, French or you know, American, whatever, it's very pure. And then one day I had some left over and I was thinking about, you know, I grew up eating, when we lived in Holland right before we came to New Orleans, my mother learned how to make the great spicy Indonesian peanut sauce.
Oh,
with soy sauce and garlic and ginger and sambal, you know, and we used to dip the pork satays in it. And that became a big family favorite. And so I kind of thought about the whole celery peanut butter thing, you know, that, you know, the celery sticks with peanut butter. And then I was thinking about this great peanut sauce, and I kind of put them together, and it's actually a delicious combination. So that's, you know, it's kind of the fun way. It's sort of like the, you know, you got peanut butter in my chocolate, you know, kind of way of creating dishes.
Well, forgive me. This is Peter. Forgive me for being a little bit confused. I mean, the restaurant is very much in the heart of New Orleans.
Yes.
The cookbook's called Crescent City Cooking.
Yes.
I looked at it carefully, and I couldn't tell whether the recipes were Bayona recipes or whether they were recipes that you had changed so that a home cook might be able to manage them rather than being in the restaurant kitchen of Bayona. Now, is that what you did, or
no,
did you
quite
just...
It's a combination. It's a lot of different recipes. It's family recipes. It's recipes I've learned, some that I created specifically for the book, some that I learn from my coworkers, you know, it's really my culinary travels. And so, of course, I've included in the book my signature dishes from Bayona and many from Herb Saint. But it wasn't necessarily meant to be a restaurant cookbook.
Okay. But it's not a home cook's cookbook either.
I believe that it is, actually.
Okay, all right.
From the feedback that I'm getting from many, many home cooks, there's quite a range of sophistication of the recipes, from very simple to, obviously, the signature dishes from the restaurant. But it's not a restaurant cookbook, necessarily.
Well, how did you resist doing one for so long?
Just didn't have the time to devote to it. I'm a very hands-on chef, and I really believe in, taking care of business and what you need to do at the time. And it really wasn't until, I hired a chef that I felt could, would run the restaurant the same way that I would. So that was when I finally found Jeremy. And I've had wonderful sous chefs and everything, but I just kind of decided to take a step back after, I started this when the restaurant was about 15 years old. I just thought the timing was right. So, so we have, like I said, we have some very simple dishes, and we have some more elaborate dishes. And there are many dishes that are not immediately recognizable as, New Orleans, Cajun or Creole or any of those things. But we also have quite a few that are. I've got a lot of shrimp dishes. I've got crawfish dishes.
I've got
things like that and crab meat. And, in fact, I had to take out several of the oyster dishes because I had so many in there,
Yeah.
But we love our oysters down here.
Whatever happened to your special store?
It was locationally challenged, and after having it open for 2 years and working 7 days a week for 2 years, and we still didn't have parking and things like that. So I just decided to stop beating my head against the wall.
Now, we were chatting off the air about things that are particularly seasonal for the holiday season generally, and particularly for New Year's, and oysters were on the tip of your tongue.
Well, it's just a great time of year for the Louisiana oysters. The cooler weather, they're just so good at this time of year, and everybody has a favorite oyster dish for their holiday table, whether it's oyster dressing or, which is like a version of, stuffing that people serve with turkeys or, that sort of thing. Or, I have... like I said, I have about 6 different oyster dishes that I love, just fried oysters on salads or oyster gratin, poached oysters with leeks and bacon over brioche or some sort of yummy toast.
Or you can just stand there with a bowl of them and just shuck them and eat them right
there. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I got some for my 65th birthday.
Did you? From Louisiana?
No, they were actually from the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, well, those are delicious, too. Anne
was confined to bed with a health problem, but she did manage to get on phone and internet
and
get me 2 dozen oysters. I gave her as many as she could eat, which was about 4 or 5, and then I ate the rest.
And you graciously consumed the rest.
I ate them all standing up, Susan.
Oh, my gosh.
I shucked them and ate them.
They're so much more briny and oceany than the oysters we have down here, which come from the brackish waters where the salt water meets the bayous.
Now, one of the things we discovered, we were down in New Orleans in February this year, and we were chatting with John Besh then, and he said one of the if there is such a thing as a good side of the hurricane that hit, it is that it flushed out all the creeks and it flushed out all the oyster beds, so the seafood's better than it's been in decades.
The oysters were great, and a lot of the public beds are really producing well right now.
Now, have you noticed, by the way, I'm just looking back over a period of time, and it seems to me that the dining options have exploded way beyond what we used to think of New Orleans restaurants in New Orleans.
I agree.
And I never thought they'd be able to pull that off, actually, because of the...
We were kind of locked in to, to a certain type of cuisine, and, some people used to say that there's, 2,000 restaurants in New Orleans and, one menu kind of thing. But really, I think that's been going on. I would have to say that's been ongoing since about the early 80s. I really think it's, the last 20 or 30 years. And, it's been great for me because that's about the time that I started cooking here. So I've seen a real, renaissance. Renovation, of the Louisiana cuisine and the local cuisine, is still a really huge part. Just like, even though I trained with French chefs and I was talking about how much I love the cuisines of the world, cooking, you know, Louisiana and the foods of New Orleans, you know, are still as much of an influence on me as anything else, you know. And so, but it's been fun to kind of update some of this stuff and incorporate new things. Like, we have a huge Vietnamese population.
Oh, yeah.
Here.
What's that one, the guy from Lemongrass who then opened
Minh Bui.
Oh, he was fabulous.
Yeah.
I went to the place he had in the bank.
Yeah, he had that, right. And that now he's got a place out on Canal Street.
He told me not to bother to go there. It wasn't his food.
Oh, I don't
know. There you go. Well, what would you say to Alan Richmond then? So when Alan Richmond wrote the article recently, they said he never really understood what all the fuss was about with his New Orleans cuisine.
I just have to say that he just doesn't seem like a very happy person. I don't know how you couldn't come to New Orleans and not, you know, not find something good to eat or not enjoy the food or be such a, you know, I just found it very mean-spirited.
Yeah, I wondered why he did that.
Yeah, I have no idea.
He's done a couple more things about this recently. Maybe he's getting potty.
I mean, it was a while ago, you know, but it was right after the storm, and it was kind of like kicking someplace when they're down. So, you know, it was just kind of an odd sort of thing.
It
felt like he had an axe to grind, but I don't really know why.
Yeah, we talked to John Besh about it, and we speculated that perhaps Al might not be coming back to New Orleans again very soon.
Well, you know. I don't know. We're a pretty friendly and forgiving lot, so maybe people would want to, you know, try harder to, you know, to please him. I'm not really sure, but you know, I think that review that came out, and it was hurtful when it came out, but I think most people have sort of gotten beyond it by now.
Great. Well, this is a truly wonderful book. It's not just a cookbook. I mean, it's got all about the preparation. I mean, I looked at the sweetbread recipe, which I hove in on because I love sweetbread so much.
Oh, that's great.
And I started reading about it, and I said, she hasn't cleaned the sweetbread yet. And the answer, of course, was you hadn't gotten around to it yet because you're working on the sauce. So then you say, well, now you start to clean the sweetbreads. But by the way, be sure to know that there are two different cuts. And the one you want is the bois, is it?
The noir.
The noir.
Yes.
The noir.
It's called the heart bread. That's the American term for it.
So that's the piece you want, and you want somebody else to clean the other parts.
Right. Oh gosh. Yeah.
Well, see, that's why I don't cook them. I mean, it's just
they're very, very labor intensive. So, you know, it's definitely not. But I thought, you know, there are people that are pretty intrepid when they, you know, decide they want to. You know, people that cook as a hobby, sometimes they really want something challenging, and you know, the sweetbreads are something that if they're even sometimes kind of difficult to find in restaurants, so it's become one of our most popular dishes over the years.
Yeah, if I see them on a menu, I must confess I usually have them.
I generally will try them, you know, but there's a lot of steps involved, and I really I had some beautiful shots of the sweetbreads poaching, you know, and I kind of wanted, you know, I was hoping, and I also had one that was cut open that I was holding in the palm of my hand to kind of show, and I thought it was terribly sexy and a really great photo, but obviously my publishers, so they chose to, you know, to put the photograph of the, you know, finished product, but, you know, I thought, wow, you know, here's something that I've never really seen many directions for in cookbooks.
What was the first recipe that you were determined to put in this cookbook when you set off to write a cookbook?
Oh, well, you know, obviously, as I said, you know, I knew that all my customers would be looking for our signature dishes. So probably the grilled shrimp with the black bean cake.
I was going to say the black bean.
Or the cream of garlic soup, one of those two.
Yeah, I would imagine. Both of those are, yeah. Yeah, I could see the black bean thing. I tried making those for years.
It's not going to be the same when we have meatloaf for dinner, is it?
No.
If there was one special ingredient we could put in meatloaf to make it really special, Susan, and we don't have any oysters, what would it be?
I make meatloaf at home pretty often, so I don't know. Yeah, I make it like my mother. She used to grate carrots into it.
Yeah.
Grating carrots. That's a good idea.
She would grate the carrots into it, and I guess it just added a little extra moisture or something, you know, but I do it just like Mom. You know, it's so funny how we do things. But, like our mothers or, you know, grandmothers or whoever it was that showed us to cook. And you don't even always know the reason for it, but you just find yourself
doing it. Peter has a very funny story that you might like if you could speed up the story taking the roast beef and cutting a section off the end. You don't remember the story?
Oh, yes.
This is a funny story.
I forget. This was a chef explaining how things.
I just read that story, and I'm trying to think of where it was.
Things get handed down from generation to generation to generation, and the way that you cooked this particular. I guess that's right.
It was a woman, and she did it just like her mother and her grandmother, and then she finally went back and asked her grandmother.
Why?
Because the pan was too small. I just read this, a couple of days ago. I wish I could remember
what
it was.
There you go. Well, that kind of thing happens in our household. What I used to try to do when my mother was still at home and we were visiting her, and we would buy a nice cut of beef, is I would do exactly that. So I would cut the end piece off so that she could have it cut, so that she could have it cooked within an inch of its life.
Oh, right.
And then I would take the rest of it and cook it properly.
Well, my mother, when I was growing up, she'd be making spaghetti sauce or hamburgers or something for us, and she would take a little pinch of the ground meat and sprinkle it with salt and eat it raw, and I used to think it was the most repulsive thing I ever saw, and I would just go, "Oh, Mom, don't let anybody see you doing that." Yeah. And now, of course, I think I make the best steak tartare in town. She had grown up, eating steak tartare in Europe, and
Susan, you make pretty much the among the best of anything in town.
Well, thank you.
I just want everybody to be reminded, go directly to our website, onthemenuradio.com, and go to OTM bookshelf and find Crescent City Cooking by Susan Spicer and order it.
I know you will not regret it. Yeah, I know, because I put it there already.
Oh, great.
And next time we come back to New Orleans, we'll have to come by and have some oysters and some steak tartare and all these other wonderful things that we talked about. Susan, thank you so much for joining us today. I know it's been a terribly busy day for you.
Oh, that's fine. Trying to get some Christmas shopping in, that's all.
There you go. when it comes to New Year's and when it comes to Mardi Gras, I'm sure you'll celebrate it properly.
We will do. Thank you so much, Peter and Ann.
Thanks, Susan.
Okay.
Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Another week, another show, and wow, wasn't that an exciting program, huh?
Well, when you line up Luke Mangan, James Oseland, Cradle of Flavor, and Susan Spicer, Crescent City Cooking, how can you go wrong?
This is about right. But I think that's another week, another program, and time to sign off.
Well, except to remind you that if you're interested in what's going on down under, you should make a point of staying with On the Menu through the spring. We're probably going to have some more previews of our trip in the next couple of weeks' programs before we take off, and then a whole new world will be out ahead of you at onthemenuradio.com.
And it's summer.
and we hope you'll all be a part of it like you always are.
Until next week.
Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.